Most of us only think about movement when something hurts. But what if that pain is your body's way of warning you that something is out of balance?
We do not feel pain in our body. It's our brain that interprets and produces what pain means.
For Vinny Crispino, an 8-time All-American athlete who broke his back and spent years chasing relief, that realization changed everything.
My brain got so good at rehearsing pain long after the herniations healed, long after the fracture healed, even basic sensation was triggering a pain alarm.
He uncovered a connection between pain, movement, and mindfulness that most people never see.
You have to heal the nervous system. It's the driver. Mm-hmm. Though it might not have started the fire, it's what's keeping it alive.
So whether you're rebuilding from injury or just trying to future-proof your body, this episode will challenge everything you thought you knew about how the body heals and stays strong. Let's dig in. Vinny, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We're doing something a little different this episode. As anyone who is watching can already tell, we are in a squatted position. I heard you say in another podcast that you were on that I listened to that you had been, I think it was mentioned, like towards the end, that you were in a squatted position for the entire time. And so I took that as a challenge to be in a squatted position the whole time while we record. We'll see how far we make it. I'm sure you will make it a lot longer than
so far. So good. We're doing
so
great. It's
so
a good start.
But what people do not know is that we've already been squatting for quite some time.
Yeah.
While the crew has set up the lighting and the audio and all that. So
yeah. So this isn't our start. Just so we're
yeah
clear.
Exactly.
Like 20
exactly.
minutes in.
Yep. So why is squatting such a foundational position?
Squatting is a position of rest. So when we're in the bottom of a squat, it is this perfect reflection of muscle balance. So when you've got great ankle mobility, knee mobility, hip mobility, the muscles in the front of the thigh work just as well with the muscles in the back of the thigh, we're allowed to assume a position of rest. When we have imbalance, when there's dysfunction, when there's restriction or tension, a squat is no longer a capable thing. One of the best parts about a squat is the more time we spend in this, the more in tune the relationship with our body becomes. So you're going to find that the muscles in the front and the back can better communicate together. It's a staple of health. It's a staple
wow.
of longevity. And you're going to hear, you know, the internet's in no short supply of people saying that squatting is a part of longevity. If we can develop the ability to get on and off the ground and be comfortable at rest in the bottom of a squat, we're probably going to have a much higher quality of life.
Yeah.
So it's definitely something to prioritize.
And I've heard that a lot of other cultures just do this very naturally and normally, even like instead of sitting.
Yeah.
It's not unusual for people to just hang out in a squatted position, you know, like eating a meal or drinking a beverage or something.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure even what I just started off with, which is a squat as a position of rest, you're going to have probably most of the audience and most people are going to say, no, because that's not my experience of it. It's a position of extreme work and discomfort. And that's usually what happens in the West, in the modern developed countries. But then you start traveling abroad and you start seeing people having conversations like this. They eat meals like this. They work like this. And we start finding that they're capable of resting in a squat because they're just spending more time in it.
Yeah.
And it's only the people that don't spend time in a squat position struggle with a squat position. And it could almost be that simple, which is the more you do it, the easier it gets.
So interesting. And there's also a debate on not necessarily being in a deep squat like this, but when you're squatting, I was taught that you should push your knees out.
Mm-hmm.
But now I know people are saying like, no, it's okay for the knees to go forward over the toes. What's your opinion on that?
The knees over the toes, or the restriction of knees over toes, came in a 1970 study from Michigan. And these Michigan researchers looked at knee pressure. And what they found is that if the knees move forward over the toes, pressure on the knees increased 28%. So anybody with knee issues heard, oh, well, there's more pressure on the knee, 28%. We don't want that. And in the 70s, when you don't really have a lot of information and you latch on to this 28% increased knee pressure, you're going to come to the conclusion that squatting is bad for your knees. Fast forward to 2003, researchers again wanted to take a look at that. They did the same test and they found, yep, that's still true. When the knees move in front of the toes, knee pressure increases 28%. But they did not look at the hip, pelvis, and the spine. And what these researchers showed is that if you allow the knees to go in front of the toes, knee pressure increases 28%, but hip and back pressure reduces 1,000%.
Whoa.
1,000%. So when we look at the body in these really narrow views of what does this do to one joint, and we try to isolate and we come up with all these like silly rules, the feet should be straight, the knees should be out, they shouldn't go over the toes. But when we take a step back from the science and we look at what is natural and what's fluid, what we're left with is, yeah, okay, we should be able to squat with the feet out, that's great, but we should also have the ability to have our feet straight and our knees together, and this should still be comfortable. And it's only when we remove all of these rules of what movement should and shouldn't be where we actually get to back to a natural state. And you're gonna find this all the time. You see people and you ask them to squat and it's like knees out, chest up, shoulders back, chin down, brace the core, do this. We're trying to like outthink movement. And what about the people who are better squatters than developed countries? They don't have personal trainers. They're not learning about the science and what's happening in the laboratories with the biomechanics and what joints should and shouldn't move. They are moving fluidly and comfortably and intuitively. So if we want to move more fluidly, we actually have to not try to outthink things, and we have to put all of the logic and the thought to the side, get back to our breath, and figure out what is the easiest way to move. You know, if you and I were in a dangerous situation, you wouldn't think, okay, I've got to get to safety, shoulders back, glutes engaged, abs fired, don't rotate the hips, move the knee. You wouldn't do this whole exhaustive movement checklist. You would just move intuitively to safety. But somewhere down the road, with modern research and science and all these rules, we become like really restricted, and it's almost like disconnected us from ourselves and our bodies.
Yeah, I always think about that phrase. I think it might be the title of a book, Civilized Beyond Common Sense. Like you said, we're creating all these rules for things based on this research, but we're forgetting that intuition that we all have about like what feels right and what doesn't.
Yeah.
I want to dive into your story because it's wild. You were a collegiate All-American swimmer and you held over 30 records in the state of Colorado before you ended up breaking your back in a surfing accident. And I listened to your first podcast episode where you talk about your story. It's a really good listen. I felt like I was in it right there with you.
Yeah.
The craziest thing to me, the thing that really stood out, was that after you broke your back in the ocean, you made it back to shore. There was no one on shore. You were in excruciating pain and you got in your car and drove 40 minutes home. I think you slept that night and then went to the ER the next day.
Yeah.
Why did you just not go straight to the ER? Like, things were popping. I mean, it sounded absolutely like excruciating.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just curious, like what personality trait in you do you think caused you to just, nope, I'm going to go home. I'm not going to get help for this.
Tell me you had childhood trauma without telling me you've had childhood trauma. You know, that's what pain does. It just amplifies and reveals everything. I learned at a young age to deal with pain internally and silently. I learned that my needs didn't really matter, and I learned to just keep it to myself. And I learned that the way I was feeling and thinking was a burden in my environment. So when I had this traumatic, back-breaking, life-changing injury, my first gut instinct and reaction wasn't, let's go be vulnerable and ask people for help. Mm-hmm. It was, I need to be alone right now, because that's how I did everything. That's how I processed stuff. When things got emotionally challenging or hard, and I was always fearful of like expressing things and them not being met the right way or being misinterpreted, when you're shaped like that as a child, you learn to just go inward into your cave when things get hard. And when there's stress, pressure, and adversity, or a back-breaking pain or an injury, you're probably gonna default to what you know. And what I know was not being vulnerable and reaching out and calling for help. What I knew was to isolate, and I knew how to be by myself. And so it's not a far stretch that in a traumatic situation, that was the default mechanism that showed up.
Yeah, interesting. And you're also very driven, I think. And so do you think, though, the flip side of that was also fueled you in your healing journey to like, once you kind of came out of that, like this mindset, I'm going to get better. Obviously, you're thriving now. So do you think there's like a flip side to that of it also allowed you, once you kind of came out of that slump, to go all in to your recovery and to building this business, is helping so many people recover from pain also?
Yeah, you know, I'll explain it like this. If you hold a cup of hot tea and somebody bumps into you and that tea spills, why did the tea spill?
It overflowed. The cup was too full and you were off balance.
Yeah, and somebody bumped into you, right?
Yeah.
Somebody else's fault. If you were holding water, the water would have spilled.
Yes.
If you were holding nothing, nothing would have spilled. Life is going to bump you, and pain does that. If you've ever experienced chronic pain or even an injury that's been around for a while, could just be acute pain, you're going to realize that that's life bumping you, and it's going to rock you because it's uncomfortable and it hurts. And it's really easy to love your body when it feels good. It's really easy to have a good relationship with yourself when you look good. It's really easy to be mindful and present when life is very easy and the world isn't pressing on you. But when you have something like a traumatic injury and what's actually inside you is like anger and frustration and resentment and betrayal and all the things, you know, I'm talking like the shadow stuff, the stuff that we try really not to show the world. When pain bumps you, which it will, it's just a matter of if and it's a matter of when and how, it's going to spill over whatever's in your cup. And this was my journey. Though it started with a back-breaking injury, the subsequent entire decade was me coming back to myself and understanding what that even meant. And that was really hard for me because I remember what it was like being in a doctor's office and seeing my broken back on an x-ray board. I remember being able to see the mess physically. I could point to the spot physically in my body where it hurt. And all of that's true. I had all the physical evidence that things were wrong and the structure was affected. But why it took so long to heal was because of how I actually showed up and the internal dialogue and the relationship with myself, how I sabotaged myself when I started to feel better. And I stopped doing my exercises because even though I didn't want to be in pain, I actually didn't feel like I deserved to be out of it. And even if things felt good, like when my back actually started to feel better and I started to understand what it felt like to have no pain, I started becoming an ultra marathon runner because I didn't know what to do without pain in my life. You know, it's much like we're in the countryside right now. This place is beautiful. But if you're used to being in the city and the traffic sounds, the people screaming, you know, chaos, and then you come out here and it's quiet and it's calm, that silence is almost uncomfortable. Not because it's bad, but because it's different and it's new. And when you normalize discomfort and you normalize pain and all of these sensations that you're used to, and then all of a sudden you realize you can remove them, you start to find different ways to recreate those. At first, it was like getting a lot of tattoos because I didn't know how to navigate feeling good. And then I ran out of real estate and I wasn't going to go on the face, you know, I had to.
Good choice.
I knew it.
Good
yeah. choice. Thank you very much.
I'm glad you stopped.
One of my better choices as a young man. But then, you know, when I ran out of real estate, it's like, okay, well, what other forms of pain can I go find?
Wow.
And then I realized, yeah, running sucks. Found it.
Let's do that.
Yeah. Let's just go do that. So
I'm starting to really feel this.
Yeah.
Are you?
Yeah.
Or you're probably good.
It's talking.
Okay. Does what I'm feeling say something about like the part of me that maybe needs work? Because I feel it in my, it's like probably my hamstrings and like my calves, mm-hmm. like the backside of my leg.
On both legs?
Yes.
Okay.
It feels so tight.
So this is one of the ways that we have to learn how to work with sensation. So notice how the brain, Albert Einstein once had this great example where he wrote 10 questions, 10 simple math questions on a board. 9 of them were right. The 10th one was wrong. And the entire class only focused on the wrong thing. We tend to hyperfixate on the discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, that's mm-hmm. true.
I'm fixated.
I can see it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yes, you're fixated. It becomes loud. It
yep.
becomes a loop. Tell me something that feels good right now.
My upper body feels pretty good.
Yeah.
My butt feels fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so when you're working with your body like this, all of those things are true for me too. The
mm-hmm.
legs are talking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the whole story. And understanding that you can hold many stories at once, that, yeah, joints are talking, nerves mm-hmm. are waking up, things are getting tired, And I'm so thankful that I can actually do this with everything my body's been through.
Yeah.
Thank you, ankles, for holding up right now. Thank you, lower back, for being able to sit through this.
Yeah.
You're smiling. We're doing it. All right, let's change the positions. Let's get more.
Okay. Whew, thanks. I don't know if I would have let myself do that.
Well,
we'll get back into it. So, straightening out my leg right now.
Look, you just had a very real experience. Now, the cool thing is you just immediately got out of that. When you're somebody who's in a body where that is the background noise all day long, almost every day, anytime you bend forward to pick up your kids or clean something up or sit and work, when that noise is in the background, imagine how loud it gets and how the brain just starts hyperfixating on it.
Yeah.
And we almost become like tunnel vision. I call it like hawk mode. You know the way like a hawk looks at something? It's so like fierce and intense. That's most people's relationship with pain. Is to like resist it, hyperfixate on it.
Yeah, of course.
Focus.
Yeah.
And so begins the formation of it becoming chronic.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get into that in regards to your story. So give us a glimpse into what the next 5-10 years looked like for you after the accident.
It looked much like everybody else's journey who's struggling with their body. What do? You first start off with the doctors. You get the drugs and the prescriptions. You get the pain pills. You get the anti-inflammatories, the muscle relaxers, the whole chemical Western concoction of like how to manage pain and try to suppress it.
Yeah, that's an interesting piece. So you were seeing a like pain management expert. Tell us what that experience was actually like.
So annoying. I thought pain management meant we were going to like
getting
fix this
free
thing.
From pain.
Yeah. Like what are you going to show me to go fix it?
Yeah.
And it was just what prescription makes sense for the pain. And that's what it was. And I think that was my breakdown. So for the first 5 years after breaking my back, it was bouncing around from doctor to doctor, PT, yoga, chiro, massage, like whatever anybody else has access to. And I was even desperate enough to go look online for like the gurus. What are like the people doing the unconventional things?
Mm-hmm.
I met this guy online who swears, you know, he did like the hammer on the spine. That's what it needed to be fixed.
I've not heard of that.
Don't do it.
Literally hammering your spine.
Yeah, it's literally like a chisel and doing one vertebrae at a time to put them back in place, which makes no sense. But I wasn't here for sense. I was here for pain relief.
Yeah.
And pain hijacks your senses really fast. So you start doing really rational things like I did. And it wasn't until year 6 where a brand new pain management clinic opened up in Calabasas and I went to it. And I was feeling hopeful. 6 years of this thing. What's going on with my body? Why aren't I getting better? And I remember leaving that doctor's office with just a brand new prescription. More drugs than anybody should be prescribed. And like, that was it. That was their grand genius plan. Nothing else. There
just
was no...
switching up the prescription.
Yeah, it was switching up. It actually wasn't even switching it. It was giving more.
Increasing.
It was just more narcotics. And I had this breakdown that... And it was a great breakdown. It was a realization that nobody's going to care about this more than I do. Nobody is going to come save me. Like, I've got to do it myself. And that's why I put myself back through school. And I just became a sponge of what the hell is the body? How does it work? And how do you put it together and come back after a life-changing injury like this?
And what did you discover?
Some really uncomfortable truths. And it's a hard conversation to have. Because if we don't have this conversation the right way, it could be very invalidating for people. By the time I got to throwing myself into modern education, everything was about the body. The psoas muscle, you have to release this muscle. If you saw a foot person, all of your back pain was coming from your feet. If you saw a neurologist, everything's coming from your nerves. If you saw a rolfer, oh, nope, it's your fascia. Everything else is fine, but it's your fascia. Everybody was trying to pick apart the body piece by piece and system by system and specialize in that system, not in any wrong or malicious way, but because that's how we're taught about the body. Go back to like young elementary school. We have the skeletal system. We've got the respiratory system. We learn about things in parts and pieces. But if you think about it, we all formed in the womb as one complete system.
Sounds about right for Western medicine.
Sounds about right, yes.
If something's going on with your skin, you see a dermatologist. If it's your hormones, you see an endocrinologist.
Yeah.
And I think Western medicine is just so quick to segment
every part of the body and not see it as a whole.
Yeah, we've got a problem here on our face, so let's go look for the expert who's working on the face. Mm-hmm. And your knee-jerk reaction isn't, well, let me look at the person who's having the problem with the face. What are their habits? What is their lifestyle? What does their food look like? What does their sleep look like? What environment are they putting themselves into? And Western medicine's great, and this isn't a dog against that, because if I get into a traumatic accident, I'm not going to go to a holistic specialist. I'm going to go to a triage specialist to help me.
Maybe you'll wait a week and then go.
Yeah, you're probably right about that. That's exactly what will happen. No, that's exactly what would happen. I know better. I know what I'm doing here. Let me put the pieces back together. And so I started to see that I had all the exercises, or as much as I thought one could have. I scoured the internet and these educational companies and these resources. I acquired credentials. What are the physical tools to solve this problem? And the reality was my fracture healed. It was healed. It's been 6 years. What we know is tissue reliably heals. If you cut your skin, it heals. If you break a bone, it heals.
I didn't realize that a broken back could heal like that. Because initially, the recommendation was that you should have surgery, which you declined.
Yeah.
But it ended up healing on its own.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I've always thought that like a broken back is something that maybe you would need a back brace for, or surgery or something, but
that's the treatment right now for it. And some cases that's rightfully so, especially if there's like a spinal cord, and that's the jump into, let's go fuse the area. Let's not put the spinal cord at risk. Let's go give this person a brace. Let's not have them be subjected to anything that's unstable that could cause severe central nervous system damage to the spinal cord. So all of that makes sense. And your body can heal, and it's actually quite good at healing. The problem, even if it started off with structural, like what mine did, I can point to the day and the time that my back broke. I had all the physical evidence in the world. This was a physical problem. Why the hell weren't the exercises working? Why were the back pain specialists, who are brilliant people in this field, why was that not helping? And where my education led me is what doesn't show up on MRIs, which is your nervous system. And how you think and how you feel, how your brain interprets sensation. What I didn't understand at the time, and I want to be really mindful here, if you would have told me halfway through my journey here, hey, Vin, the reason why you're not healing is because of your relationship with yourself, I would have flipped you off. And I would have said, that's not true. You're wrong. I remember being that defensive guy because I had the evidence that that's what was true for me. And I couldn't have been more wrong. And that's the hard pill that needed to be swallowed. My brain got so good at rehearsing pain long after the herniations healed, long after the fracture healed, even basic sensation was triggering a pain alarm.
And that's the case for a lot of people, right? I mean, I think I've heard you say that for 25% of people, the pain still remains even after the body structurally has healed. So what's going on with that?
Here's what's objectively true. Every body has a brain. We do not feel pain in our body. It's our brain that interprets and produces what pain means. So for example, like we don't see with our eyes, we see with our brain. You can have perfect functioning eyes, but if you have brain damage, it affects your vision. We don't hear with our ears, we hear with our brain. Again, same thing. If we have brain damage, or if our brain misinterprets auditory signals, we get really confused here. When you have a dysregulated nervous system and you have an injurious event, like I did, a traumatic accident, you get really good at producing pain responses in the brain. Here's what that means. There was a study done in 2012, so we're talking like 13 years ago. No, that's 15 years ago.
Yeah.
This study looked at people who just experienced back pain, and with an 85% accuracy, they were able to determine, not by looking at the structure or the damage or the injury, who was going to be in pain a year later.
How?
By looking at the brain. specifically two regions of the brain, the medial prefrontal cortex and the nucleus accumbens. These are areas of the brain that deal with meaning, storytelling, threat, and reward. So I'm talking about fear-based systems here. Is there a reward for pain? What is your meaning with pain? And they found the more these two regions of the brain talk together, the significantly the higher the chance somebody was going to be in chronic pain and not heal. Even if the injury healed, they were still going to experience the injury the same. Because we have to understand that our body is riddled with nerves. Nerves that tell us if something touches us. Nerves that tell us if there's pressure, heat, cold, warmth, whatever it is. Right now, the nerves are giving us a sensation that we're sitting on our hips. These are all normal, neutral signals. But what happens when your brain misinterprets those signals as bad and as harmful, as dangerous? What happens when you feel unsafe as a person? And remember that little teacup analogy? You have fear, anger, and a lack of safety just living inside of you because of what you've been through. And now all of a sudden your brain latches onto fear, or it latches onto pain. You are going to replicate that pain signal again and again and rehearse it. And the more you rehearse it, the more it happens. Now, let me make that real for somebody. If it hurts to bend forward, you bend forward and it hurts. How many times do you think your brain needs to experience that before it predicts bending forward is going to hurt? Without you even bending forward, your brain thinking about it is already producing a tension and a lack of safety, a fear response. This is no different than Pavlov and his dogs when he was trying to figure out what is a conditioned response. And he'd ring a bell, he'd feed dogs food, and then the dogs would salivate. He stopped feeding the dogs food, kept ringing the bell, and the dogs would keep salivating. So we know conditioned responses happen. And when you condition and rehearse pain, it doesn't matter what the injury is. It's actually not even about structural problems. The brain rehearses fear, therefore it rehearses pain.
So you have to heal the nervous system, essentially?
You have to heal the nervous system. It's the driver. Mm-hmm. Though it might not have started the fire, it's what's keeping it alive. Though maybe there's an autoimmune issue, maybe there's an actual traumatic structural injury or an accident, maybe there was something congenital that you're born with, that all could be true. But the driver of the pain is and will always be the nervous system. And what we now know with modern science, there was a brilliant study done in 2015. They did MRIs on 3,110 people, which I think is a pretty significant control group. They found that 64% of these people without pain had the same MRIs as the people who have pain. Disc disease, herniations, stenosis, spondy, all of these things that we're told, this is why your back hurts. You've got spondy. You've got degenerative disc disease. You've got this going on with the discs. All of that is present in people without pain. So objectively, we know structure alone is not the driving cause of pain. It's the nervous system, and it's the brain's meaning that it puts on pain.
So once you discovered that, what did you do to heal your nervous system?
Well, I first denied the hell out of it. I resisted every bit of that truth because my entire formal education was, you know, exercise physiology from Stanford School of Medicine. It was posture alignment therapy through Augusta University. Everything in my world was biomechanics, and I just had to break down that entire model and ditch it and move into the nervous system.
Yeah, because you were faced with this reality of like seeing that, okay, structurally everything's good, but I still have this pain. So it's like wrestling with that and probably, yeah, just having to be confronted with the fact that there's more to the story here.
Yeah. And there, I resisted the hell out of it. And there were two moments, and I'll never forget these moments, where that actually became a truth for me. And I actually experienced what they're talking about. So one of my rehab exercises, which is probably most people's, is doing bridges, right? Laying on the ground, lifting your hips up and down. For a guy with my history and backstory, they were a nightmare. It literally asked all those muscles. I felt this tug of war. Bridges hurt every time I did them. And I'll never forget it. It was a Saturday morning, early in the morning, try to get my PT done so I can try and be like a present available father. Oh God, and these dreaded bridges came up. And I'm doing them and like I'm pain wincing. This movement sucked. And then my son comes in the room. He was probably like 4 or 5 at the time. And he tells me this little joke that wasn't even like funny, but the way he said it, it was so hilarious to me in the moment. And I just started cracking up while doing these bridges. And after laughing with him, he's giggling. He's got those like little kid belly laughs that just, it makes me laugh harder. And so we were caught in this like laughter hysterical loop. And then all of a sudden, like, wait a second, I'm doing my bridges and like they don't hurt.
Mm.
What is going on here? And I panicked and I thought it was a breakthrough. What's happening? And then the moment my attention shifted back to my movement, the pain came right back. And so it was this weird like little blip of why did what I was focusing on entirely change my relationship with something that was very predictable? This movement sucked for me.
I'm thinking of childbirth as you're saying this.
Tell me more.
Because there was a moment with my middle child. I was in labor and our midwife is like trying to figure out how to make coffee. Okay. So that was her biggest concern. I was literally like, I was almost ready to push. Okay. And pushing takes a while for me. So, but I was there, you know, and she's like wanting her cup of coffee. We're at home. I've done home births. And so she's like, I'm in the tub, almost ready to push. My husband's there. She's like going up to my husband, like, hey, like the coffee maker's not working. I'm doing this and this, and it's not making coffee. And he's like trying to explain it to her. And so she goes downstairs, comes back up, like, yeah, it didn't work. And I'm like, it sounds like a nightmare maybe to some people, but honestly, it like took me out of the moment.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is great. This is so casual. Like everyone's just hanging out. She's worried about her coffee. This is no big deal. I can do this. It totally like took me out of the pain that I was feeling in that moment. So I just thought of that when you said that, like, having like an outside experience that kind of mentally causes you to feel removed from that source of pain for a moment, it can be really powerful.
And you just did, maybe not at the time with the clinical definition of it, you did a somatic tracking experience. You showed your brain that there's more to the story of what you're physically feeling than you're paying attention to. And by shifting your field of vision, by shifting your attention, you're able to place attention differently in your brain and body, which then allows you to come back to it a little different.
How do you do that if you're not forced to do that? Like you, like your son came up to you, you know, my midwife was making the coffee. It's like, how does one just muster? I mean, I'm sure it's not like mustering up the, you know, the effort to take yourself out of it. Like, how does that work if you aren't met with that distraction?
Yeah. So the distraction can show you that it's possible.
Yeah.
But there's an actual process that you can do to actually create that every single time. And that's the gift of pain. The sensation being there is the reminder to do a somatic experience. Not in a forced way, every time I feel pain, I've got to go do this. That puts more pressure and judgment on the brain. But it's in a way of, number one, when you feel a sensation come in, is actually just observing that. Not reacting to it, not going with it, but taking this deep breath and be, oh yeah, there's sensation. Oh yeah, the back is talking to me. That's what's showing up for me.
Almost seeing it as information, collecting the information and taking inventory of it rather than letting yourself be immersed in it.
Yeah, because most people are going to find that there is no observation of the sensation. It's a sensation that is followed by an immediate reaction. And that reaction amplifies the sensation. Oh God, this means I'm broken. I'm ruined. I knew I was doing something wrong. I'll never get better. I'm getting old. I'm failing. I hate my body. The list goes on. And this goes back to that study, right? How we attach meaning to pain determines who's going to be stuck in this loop. So step one is being able to actually identify the loop. There's that sensation again. What is the story that shows up? For me, it was my back's broken. Bridges were proof that I was broken. My son showed me that there's possibility that maybe I'm not broken because I could do this. So step one is identify the sensation. identify the loop. What do I feel? And what is the story that shows up? Step two is being able to interpret that sensation. Is that story true? Is that real for me? My interpreting the signal, remember, when your brain misinterprets things, that's where chronic pain can really have its breeding ground. It's, well, my back isn't broken. It's no longer broken. It once was, but it now is not. I'm not in any danger here. I've got a roof over my head. I've got food in my fridge. I've got a loving son next to me. I am safe right now in this moment. And then step three, which is invite safety back in. And maybe it's with a breath. Maybe it's with calm reassurance that I'm allowed to feel this, and that doesn't mean I'm not okay. I'm allowed to feel this, and I allow it here. There are all of these ways in working with sensation. The problem is nobody's born with these. It is a very human thing to feel something uncomfortable and resist it. And the challenge is we treat pain like how we would treat nobody. We feel bad. We meet ourselves with criticism, judgment, a lot of force, a lot of resistance, a lot of negativity. But we wouldn't meet like a loved one who's in pain like that. And that's where the inner relationship shows up. How you meet sensation determines what experience you're going to have with it. And I, like most people, had zero framework other than a big middle finger. And other than, I hate this, pain felt like betrayal. Every time I felt pain, I thought about this like young strapping athlete, and now I can't even like put shoes on. I made pain mean so much that I was not just feeling sensation. I was feeling my whole identity being changed. No wonder why it wasn't changing. No wonder why there was no exercise in the world that was going to change that for me. But I learned how to use exercise as the stimulus to retrain safety and to provide reassurance. And from that moment on, the next 13 something years were about how do you work with sensation when it shows up. I give people exercises and they're going to feel a lot like we would have, like we just felt a lot in a squat. And then what is the story and how do we work with that to change the nervous system and the capacity of the body to heal?
So it's bringing the mind and the body together in the exercises, but doing them with the right mindset and kind of the process that you mentioned.
Yeah.
And that's the key to getting better.
Yeah. It's always been the key.
Yeah.
Because the body can heal. There's no like healer out there. We can biohack certain ways and inject. We can do things to maybe facilitate healing, but your body's phenomenal at healing. The question is are you going to get in your own way and make this 10 times harder and more intense than it needs to be? And what if pain was really the calling to form a better relationship with ourselves? And if we can start to reframe pain and start to question it, maybe with a little bit of curiosity, it doesn't become this thing that makes us hard and tense and that we fight. It becomes this thing that we almost like, what are you here to show me? What am I missing? You're really smart, body. You are brilliant. Like, what do you know that I don't know? Teach me.
Yeah.
And that's gut instinct. We can feel around with people who maybe aren't the right people to be around. Like, it's our body talking to us. But we vilify pain as the bad guy. It's just a messenger.
Yeah, it's information.
That's all it is.
You also talk about focusing on the basics over specifics, yeah. Which I think is very counterintuitive and also probably goes a lot against what a lot of traditional physical therapy would have us believe, that if our knee hurts, we need to do exercises that to rehabilitate the knee versus it may be another part of the body that's broken, but it's showing up in a totally different area.
Yeah. Yeah. All the time. And, you know, I always say people to train the basics before specifics for that exact reason. Yeah. I know your knee hurts. I know your back hurts. I know you have a specific thing that you're working through. And that specific thing naturally makes you look for a specific solution. And so begins the looking for the proverbial needle in a haystack. If we can take a step back and ask basic questions, how do both ankles work? Do both knees bend? How do the hips rotate and flex and extend? What kind of motion does the pelvis have? How does the spine move? We're talking basic movement patterns. Can you bend, squat, twist? Let's restore the basics of human movement. And in so many cases, let's watch how those little specific problems actually clear themselves up. Because a specific problem, your knee didn't just wake up one day and say, hey, I'm just going to stop working. Let's go bone on bone now. It's the consequence, it's the outcome of all of the basics for days, weeks, months, and years not stacking up to work together.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Yeah.
Why is rest not necessarily the best prescription for pain?
It depends on where you're at in the injury stage. When I just broke my back and crushed it against a rock, rest was pretty important. That's really useful. Rest can be an ally in calming down your system. But that's such a short period of rest actually being useful. What does movement do? Movement's medicine. And when I say that, I mean, every time we move, we are calling in blood, oxygen, and nutrients into the areas that we're moving. Every time we move, we are flushing out metabolic waste products like lactic acid and other things that just happen when the cells naturally turn over. Movement is this beautiful flushing mechanism. And when we choose to not move, we never actually get to give the areas the nutrients and the oxygen and the blood that they need. And so all of a sudden, and even the doctor that came out with the RICE method, which was rest, ice, compress, and elevate, has since recanted. This is not really good information.
Wow. I was going to ask you about icing next.
It actually slows down the healing process.
Is there any circumstance in which someone should ice an injury?
It can be great for pain relief. You know, it can be soothing. And we're not vilifying ice. It shouldn't be the strategy. Sometimes after I go on my long runs, ice just feels great on my feet and ankles to revitalize sensation with so much pavement pounding. But at the end of the day, rest and ice should not be the strategy. They can be little friends that you make along the road. Most people will rest their way into the next injury because the moment, and this is where we could open up a whole different can of worms. If you feel pain and you meet it with rest, you're showing your body that pain is bad. And therefore, we should no longer move.
You're letting it boss you around.
You're letting it boss you around. And the moment your brain figures out pain equals rest, that becomes the underlying strategy. And just like our body can adapt and get stronger when we work out, if you've ever been in shape and then have taken a week or two off, you know the opposite is also true. Mm-hmm. We lose it quickly. That deconditioning happens when we rest. So if we've got this injured body, it's weak, it's got muscle imbalances, it already has a hard time moving, and we are now taking movement out of the picture, what is happening to the tissue? And this is how a short-term acute issue can become long-term chronic, because we're literally resting our way into chronic pain. We get weaker, the weaker we get, the more we fear movement. And rightfully so, because the more load and stress movement creates in our body, the more pain we feel. And so we all start to hop on this hamster wheel of rest is the only thing I can do now.
Yeah.
And movement is scary as hell.
I've noticed that. I've never had, thankfully, a serious injury, but I've twisted my ankle plenty of times. And I've noticed that when I've rested afterwards, it doesn't seem to heal as well. Like if I do it and then I'm like resting and then go to sleep and then I wake up the next morning and it's killing me. Whereas if I just kind of do gentle walking after I like twist my ankle, it kind of just goes away.
Yeah. The new model is how can we get movement as quick as possible? Not to be negligent or rush into it, but how do we get these tissues to actually become alive again? And that is always about force and putting load into them. That's what heals the body.
I'm curious, as someone who is so well versed in physiology and anatomy and just physically, like physical structure stuff. So like I said, I've never had a serious injury. The most pain I've experienced has been during childbirth.
Nobody in my audience is going to relate to that at all. And I love that for you. That's great. I'm very proud.
I don't know why. I mean, I have other issues, but like I feel like I've always been pretty agile. But I'm curious, if you were to assess me, are you noticing anything that's like, I don't know, are my shoulders imbalanced? There's like, when I was squatting, did you notice anything of like, oh, that's not quite right? What do you see?
I could go pull up a textbook right now and we could go find 100 things to go change.
Mm.
But that doesn't mean they need to change. Because what I notice above physiology, above form and function, is you seem to have a very healthy, well-balanced relationship with yourself. You seem to be very grounded and very present, which means anything that's slightly off is not going to get amplified into a full-blown cataclysmic, you know, problem that's going to sideline you. Even you, hearing you talk earlier before a podcast started about your experience of childbirth, and I asked you, like, were you the outlier in that? Because it sounds like healthy, like it sounds normal, and you were surrounded by a really good community. All of these things, so little people are experiencing. So the moment the body shifts and the weight moves over to the right side, it becomes like amplified and problematic. And all of a sudden, all of these like weird stories, my right side is a bad side, left side's a good one. These stories just like take off. And that's more of the problem to fix than the biomechanics themselves. You know, the other thing I want to add to that is when people first come to me for help, it's they slap the MRIs on the table, assess this, assess that. First thing I'm assessing is how comfortable you are in your own body. Can you make eye contact? Is it hard to find you? Are you here with me right now? Or are we really shifty and having a very difficult time like connecting? That's one of the biggest things that reveals what your what is actually happening underneath the hood right now. What is going on in your physiology, aside from hip mechanics or pelvic tilt and motion, aside from lower back rhythm? Yeah, that stuff's important, but if you're very shifty and scattered, again, I could give you the most precise mobility drill to address your core compensation or dysfunction, and none of it matters if you're not here with me. And if all you're doing is trying to numb, escape, suppress, and avoid sensation, you suppress emotions, I don't know what exercise I can give you.
Yeah.
I can try to meet you physically and then over time bring you back to like the real center of the problem. But that's why it's more than just objective mechanics. And that's the biggest thing that's changed in my practice. If you would have met me 10 years ago, I wouldn't have gotten to know you as a person. Didn't matter. Just send me your posture photos, send me your squat. I'll tell you exactly what to go do. And for about half of the people, it was great. For the other half of the people, it didn't work. And for years, I didn't understand why are only half of humans dealing with the laws of physics, but the other ones are. Like, what is the variable that makes somebody come here and have profound change and somebody with the same injury come here and see no change? And it's this.
Yeah.
And it's what's going on up here. That's everything.
Makes so much sense.
Yeah.
But it's wild. Like 50%, those are not very good odds.
No.
But I'm just thinking most people who are in pain, seeing, you know, whatever physical therapist is covered by insurance, like they're not factoring all of that in.
Mm-mm.
What about for those, the few of us who are not like living in any sort of chronic pain, but also just want to optimize mobility for longevity and to hopefully avoid dealing with that in the future? Why is this important to put into practice, or is it important to put all of this stuff into practice now so that we don't have to deal with any kind of pain in the future or minimize pain in the future?
What we're talking about here is quality of life. Just because there isn't a problem, that doesn't mean one can show up. So this is why pain should not be the end-all be-all compass that people use. If I'm in pain, I've got a problem. If I'm not in pain, that means I don't have a problem.
Flies are everywhere right now.
Finally got me. If you're pain-free, if you've got this great relationship with your body, great. Let's go figure out how to use this vessel. Let's figure out how to train it in a sustainable way so you can be this person in your 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond. It's really a matter of how do we want to age, what kind of level of activity that we want to hold on to, and more importantly, what is the quality of life that we want to experience? How many things do we want to be capable of saying yes to? And the challenge is you're the only person who can make that decision. Nobody can try to scare you into that. If you don't do this, then this is going to happen. Fear-mongering doesn't work. This is really about like you getting honest with yourself and understanding you've got one experience of life. What do you want that experience to be? How long do you want to experience being in this like physical, vibrant body? And then can we start to say yes preemptively to make that happen?
Yeah, I want that. I want to be playing with my great grandkids one day. And that's certainly not the case for most people in America. But I know in a lot of other cultures, people age and they continue to add value to society rather than kind of being a burden. I think that's also about how we treat our elders and all of that factors in. But yeah, I know that hip injuries from falls, once that happens to someone, it impacts their lifespan significantly. I mean, a lot of people just really go downhill after that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, the sometimes hard conversation. And again, this isn't out of fear. This is like, let's just get really practical about it. An arthritic hip in your 50s starts when you're 30. You know, these things don't just all of a sudden you have it. It's all about the habits and the behaviors and how you take care of yourself now determines what kind of vessel you're going to have as you age. And so if your goal is to be present for your grandkids, not just sitting in a chair rocking back and forth, but outrunning your kids as parents and showing them how to do it, and you're like literally handing them the baton,
yeah,
then the question is, how can we start taking care of the self now to be able to do that long term? And that means we probably make a couple shifts. It's less about maybe what fitness was in our younger athletic days of proving, and it's more about sustainability. How can I do what I'm doing today to make sure I can do it again tomorrow? And then next week, so on and so forth. And we're really logical. There's no finish line we're trying to rush to. We're not trying to hit the 300-pound squat club anytime soon. We're just trying to take care of this body as we age gracefully.
Are there certain movements or positions that people should really start to hone in on and get comfortable in if they want to optimize their physiology for longevity?
Yeah, and it's actually, if we want to talk about optimizing physiology and longevity, we actually, and movement, we've got to have a conversation on the flip side of that coin, which is no movement. How can we put the body into a position of rest? So what I mean specifically is laying on your back with both legs over a couch or a chair. Hips and knees are in 90 degrees. Probably could have had the whole podcast like that. It would have been way more comfortable than a squat.
I'm going to get back into a squat.
Yeah, I'll join you. Can we bring ourselves down to a position of rest? And can we tap back into our breath? I'm talking about the down state, that parasympathetic nervous system, the part of you that is responsible for releasing tension and relaxing your body, reducing muscle imbalances, the part of you that you can get into after a fight with a loved one or a really hard work day, or when you feel like you're entering survival mode. How can we actually let go of that tension? And if we want to move better, it starts by actually getting good at a lack of movement. Mm. Can we actually find ourselves in stillness? So then you can do any number of exercises. Burpees for seniors, which is literally lying in a face down position, pushing yourself up to the knees and standing back up, then getting back down. Doing simple movements like that are more available because we're entering it from a relaxed state. Not this, I've had a bad day at work, had a fight with a partner, let me go take this out on my body. That's not longevity. It's less about the exercise itself. And I think that's what most people expect from me. Go do this and go do this and go do that. It's not what we do, it's how we do it. That's what determines if we're going to be doing it for long at all.
So that position of being on your back and legs up, bent over like a couch, or what about legs straight up on the wall? I hear a lot about that.
You can do legs straight up the wall. So that definitely has sensation and stimulus to it. If you've got tight hips, that's a great one. If your hamstrings were a little overactive in the squat, yeah, you're probably spending time with your legs up the wall. It's great. It's inversion. It puts your blood flowing downstream, which is great. A lot of benefits. I teach that exercise in my program. And not all time spent with your body is about going and doing and changing. It's also about what's checking in and what's currently going on. And we're missing that piece. And that's why, regardless of your sex and your age or whatever condition you have, the very first step in my program is, can we bring this very overactive, high stressed out body into a down state? Can we actually downregulate the nervous system? Because if I start throwing exercises at you, you're going to do all of the exercises with the problems that you're wanting to change. If you've got a hip disparity, one hip stronger than the other, I could give you a longevity exercise and you go crank the hell out of squats. Are you not just continuing to use that overactive hip while the other hip just atrophies and gets weaker? This is why it all comes down to, can we first regulate the nervous system? Let's do the work on the ground. So when it comes time for a squat, you've got both sides of your body showing up. That's longevity work. It's not what you do, it's how you're doing it.
How bad is sitting for humans?
I think it's fantastic.
Really?
I'm going to take a different approach. Now, the approach, I wish I was the pioneer in this. I'm going to take a page from Professor Daniel Lieberman. He is a Harvard professor in evolutionary biology and paleoanthropology, and he has a brilliant stance on this. Sitting is the new smoking if you're a Westerner and you go off of Western information. Most of our understanding about the body comes from a very small percentage of the actual world population. We're talking 1-3% is actually a civilized modern culture. And that's what we're basing all of our information. That's where all of our studies come from. If you want to understand the human body, we have to take a step outside of Western culture and look worldwide. How have all of these different cultures and civilizations evolved to move? And what we're going to find is that even in the most primitive hunter and gatherer tribes, they have significant periods of rest to conserve caloric expenditure. It's evolutionary to be able to rest for long periods of time. Where we get in hot water is the difference between some of these hunter and gatherer tribes. They have more vigorous spurts of activity, which makes them much healthier. Whereas we tend to not really throttle our heart rate, right? They might have to go into sprints. They might have to do very heavy, vigorous work. Whereas that tends to be missing from most modern developed countries, right? We DoorDash to get our food. We have people grocery shop for us. Whatever it is, we drive to the grocery store. We don't really move that much outside of our sedentary life. So it's not that sitting is dangerous. It's actually we're hardwired to sit. That's where our body can actually repair and rest and heal tissues. If we're always on the go, that creates other metabolic issues. So sitting is crucial. The topic that we've got to talk about is, are there different ways to sit that are better?
That's what I was going to ask you.
Okay, great. So this is a fantastic conversation. Jonathan Gordon, who is another famous paleoanthropologist, he studies cultures and civilizations all over the world. And he studied and found over 100 different sitting postures in cultures without chairs.
Wow.
100. I study movement for a living. I don't think I could tell you 100 different ways to sit. Because when you remove the chair, like we've done, not only are we sitting in a squat, but we might shift a little bit. Mm-hmm. Or we might move to this. Now one hip's in flexion, one knee's in a little bit more flexion as well. We're shifting the work around. And that's what these tribes have that beats our chairs, is by not having a chair to sit in, those people are being exposed to more variations of movement. Therefore, the more shapes you can make when you're moving or when you're sitting, when you're at rest, the easier it is to get in and out of shapes when it comes time to move.
Yeah. And even if they are sitting on like a rock or a log, it's like they're not all totally uniform. So there's still some shifting that's taking place.
Everything's different. Every log, every rock might be a little different. And it might be sit here for a couple of minutes, stand up and go sit somewhere else. So the total time spent sitting and resting is almost the same as Western civilizations. It's the vigorous activity that's different. And it's the amount of movement when we sit. It's how we're sitting.
So that's a fascinating distinction. I'm just thinking about our world and how our culture, our civilization is built on traditional chair sitting, like in cars, in flights, in the office. What can people do for those unavoidable times where we have to sit for a long time? You told me you drove 3.5 hours here this morning sitting in a car. So is there anything we can do to optimize our movement for those times where we have to sit in like a traditional chair seated type of position?
There's two main ways to look at this. Might sound like a little bit of an offshoot, but if you think about it like therapy, the point of therapy isn't to remove stress from your life. The point of therapy is to get better at dealing with whatever stress is in your life, make you more competent and equipped, and give you tools. It's the same thing with sitting. Your fitness routines, your mobility work, the strength, all of the stuff you're doing outside of sitting should better prepare you to be able to sit, because sitting is unavoidable. It's a modern world. And there's nobody that's going to be able to just get up every 5 minutes at their desk and do exercises when you're in a corporate environment or you've got to like make money for a living, you know? So we have to get really practical that sitting is unavoidable, just much like stress is unavoidable. It's about, can we prepare our body to deal with the stress of sitting? And when I say You want to come in?
He's coming in.
You want to sit with us, buddy? You're still checking me out.
This is our guard dog, Doug.
Yeah. He deserves to be here. You want to have a seat?
He really likes you. He doesn't usually come around this much during podcasts.
So what I was saying is, you know, if you cannot get out of sitting, then it's about how can we prepare our body better outside of sitting. That just comes with strength work. It comes with mobility work. So that way work and force and load is evenly distributed with the body. So it's not just lower back that's holding you upright. You feel a little bit more general support as you're sitting. If you do have the option, then it's just about injecting some motion into your day. When I started this work, I used to dedicate 1 hour of mobility a day to my body. And that was a really big commitment. And that was a great step one. As I've mastered movement and learned what really needs to happen, I now don't have an hour of dedicated motion. It's like microdosing motion all day long. It's maybe getting up and doing this simple movement here. Maybe sitting down, it's doing some hip exercises. Maybe I'll grab a yoga block and put it between my knees and just squeeze both knees together to get the hip muscles active. Maybe I'll put a strap around my legs in the middle of a long work meeting and press outward against the strap to remind my back that I also have my hips here to support me. So there's these little micro things. You can even see me cooking in the kitchen, and I'll cook and I'll stir something, and then I'll go into like a simple little hold or a stretch, something to remind my body that it's capable of moving. And I noticed when I shifted from this 1 hour of dedicated motion and to just trying to trickle it more throughout the day, my body felt more capable and better.
I love that approach.
Yeah.
And it's like what kids do naturally, you know, they're always fidgeting, like always moving around. And I think that's so much healthier than just living a sedentary lifestyle, but getting in like a half hour of a heavy workout in and then going back to being sedentary.
Yeah, it's heroic bursts. And one of the big frontiers that I've got across with everybody who comes to me for help, step one is learning the exercises. That's great. It's helpful. But what about the other 23 hours of the day? What are we doing in those other 23 hours that's winding up the problem that we're here to change? And when you look at a kid and you see they don't have expensive coaches, they don't have really intensive training, they just are.
They're intuitive.
They're intuitive. They're constantly just figuring out what works and what doesn't work. There's a sense of play that comes with movement, which is why it doesn't feel like a chore for them.
Yeah, and they stretch. I remember like I would wake up and just like naturally just like, ugh, like stretch. Like we don't even do that anymore. I try to remind myself to do that.
When my dog does it, I'm like, okay, you're right. I probably should. She stretches all the time. It's so natural. And that's what we've got to get back to this natural sense. But maybe at the start, let's put some guardrails on it. Let's come up with a dedicated routine. Let's get you in the habit, and then let's start to expand and just start to move our bodies more.
I've become really averse to traditional sitting. So when I'm driving, like people always make fun of me, but like this leg's like up, like this leg's on the gas and one leg's like either I'm sitting like it's across my knee or it's like up and kind of positioned with my foot on the seat. But I just feel like getting my legs up and putting them in different positions as much as I can when I'm either driving or on a flight seems to help a lot too.
It's just movement.
Yeah.
That's all it is. And I think we want movement to be complicated, like some golden answer of this guy's going to tell me this one. Is this how
Doug,
you get to know
Doug, the dog's back. Man, he really likes you. This doesn't ever happen.
Well,
maybe because we're on his level.
We understand each other.
Rich, our producer, is over there with some treats, some steak. Seems to be working.
There we go. Yeah, and you know, I think people are expecting like a really complicated answer from me. And just moving more is the answer. Like if you want to get better at squats, it's not about finding some random weird exercise that you've never done, which is then going to unlock the squat. It's let's practice squats. Let's check a few emails in a squat. Let's go grab a really low stool and spend time watching our favorite show on that stool. And the more exposure that we can get in these positions, we're going to find the easier it gets. Now, if you're being told, hey, just move more, the very first thought most people have is, I don't know how. And that's the work, that's that gap we need to cross. Because what we're really talking about here is a disconnection event of intuitive movement. we no longer trust what we feel. We're being told, sit like this. Nope, sit like that. Squat like this. No, this is bad for you. Don't do... There's so much fear and so much chaos when it comes to movement that we've almost locked ourselves out of our body because we don't understand pain. Western medicine makes pain the bad guy. So if you fear it, I cannot tell you how many people who have thrown significant numbers at me to have me watch them move because they don't trust their body. And that at the heart of it is what we need to address. Why do you no longer trust sensation? Because it doesn't feel safe in your body. It no longer feels like home. So no matter what movement we do, that's what we have to address. And what I love giving people is movements that start to feel like home again, so they can start to tap this intuitive playfulness. That's what's missing. Yeah.
Do you own furniture in your home?
Yeah, I do.
You do?
And I use it often.
You use it?
Yeah.
Because I know there's some people that are even anti-furniture.
Yeah, some people are anti-furniture, and I'm not one of those. I enjoy a good chair. You know, it doesn't need to be dogmatic, no pun intended, but practicing and playful. Sometimes I don't want to sit on the ground. Sometimes I don't want to sit in a squat. Sometimes I want to lay on my bed with my girlfriend and watch a show or connect, whatever it is we're doing. You should be allowed that. And I think, you know, again, and maybe we don't have to go down this road, but it's all about like how it's being preached. You're allowed to sit for hours a day. Oh, we got two. Hi, guys. Thanks for coming today.
Oh, my gosh.
Thanks. You know, like you're allowed to sit for 12 hours, and that doesn't mean you have to be in pain. That doesn't mean you should be in pain. You're allowed to go for long car drives. You're allowed to take days off of your movement, mobility, you know, your mobility routine. All of these things are allowed. But if your relationship with this stuff is sitting's bad, what kind of experience do you think you're going to have at the office?
Mm-hmm.
If you're being told sitting is the cause of your problems, whether that's true or not, which we can't objectively say, what is your experience that you're going to have with sitting? It's not going to be great. And it's going to further put you in stress when you're already stressed out for work.
Weighted vest walking is all the rage right now. What's your take on that?
I love it.
I love it too. I was hoping you would say that because I'm such a fan and I have noticed such a big difference personally doing it.
I had a buddy, Thomas DeLauer. He sent me a message probably 3 or 4 weeks before this event. He won the lottery in getting tickets to go summit Mount Whitney. And
so fun. I did that in college.
It was incredible. I've never done that before. And he hits me up a couple weeks before. I wasn't originally invited to go, but somebody dropped out. So I was a great backup. And I realized, am I in Whitney shape?
Yeah.
And also, not only Whitney shape, but like Thomas DeLauer Whitney shape. He's probably going to want to run up this and run down it. So how do I get in shape really fast for it? I got a weighted vest, put 60 pounds in it.
Wow.
And that made
is heavy.
It neck, I had to do a lot of neck stuff. That was way too much load, way too fast, too quick. But what I learned is that a 3-hour hike felt like 6 to 10 hours.
Yeah.
And it rapidly increased the intensity, which meant that I got ready in like 3 weeks for something that probably should have taken a few months to get ready for.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you do it in one day?
We did it in one day. We literally powered up it and tried to run down it. It was a phenomenal experience.
You ran down?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Well, we tried to. So as soon as we got to the top, we summited, we took our photos as proof we made it. And then we're feeling like spriteful and youthful and like, let's just send this down, man. We were basically fasted. He had a couple beef patties on him. Hey, guys.
Oh my gosh. This is amazing.
Thanks for joining us today. And then we literally were like, you know what? Let's do it. Let's bomb down. And
did it hurt your knees?
It didn't hurt my knees, but probably about half a mile into it, we forgot we were at altitude. Some like 14, I think it's like
14,000 something.
Yeah, 14,500 feet. And mistakes were made. And so we're like, all right, we don't have to be heroes here. We did it. Now let's just actually enjoy the downhill.
Yeah.
So it was a great experience, but rucking was a huge, powerful thing. I felt it got me in better shape than running did because it was more work, more strength with less impact.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a huge fan of it. I have nothing but great things to say about it.
Cool. Okay. I'm so glad. I asked you about the knees because, yeah, like I said, I did Mount Whitney in college and also Mount Kilimanjaro, and climbing or, you know, going up the mountain was never the hardest part for me. It was coming down because, and I'm not someone that deals with knee pain,
But in the, both of those cases,
yeah,
my knees were killing me by the end of it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that would be different now. I wasn't eating a clean diet. There was probably more inflammation. But what do you think was to blame for that?
You know, it's funny. When I first started becoming an ultramarathon runner, I chose a hell of a course to do it. It was a 50-mile route in the old Cascadia mountain range with 16,000 vertical feet. So this wasn't just 50 miles. This was 50 miles up and down some serious mountains. And so my concern was like the getting up part, because I did not have the strength and endurance. I hadn't even ran a marathon at that point. I just decided to go for 50. I ended up hiring a coach.
It's like extreme podcasting right here.
Yeah. Yeah. We're just getting into it. I hired a coach, Zach Bitter, who's the world record holder in the 100-mile race. Like, who better to teach me how to solve an endurance issue than literally the world's fastest man over 100 miles? And I remember the very first call I had with him. I'm like, all right, man, what's the strategy? How do we do this? And he said, your problem's not going to be the uphill. It's the downhill. I'm like, no, I just float downhill. That's like gravity working with me. He's like, no. The amount of control it takes to decelerate your mass moving down will burn your quads in a way no uphill ever will. And so his main goal with training was for me to walk uphill and run downhill. So I had to find the highest mountains I could and just train the downhill part, because that was going to be, he was convinced, the determining factor of if I was going to finish or not, was if I had downhill mechanics.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what makes people tap.
Yeah, it's very underrated.
Yeah, if you're lacking the equation, control and the stability to slowly move down, it's going to be a challenge for sure.
What's the most overrated fix for chronic pain?
I'm cycling through every hack that has ever come across.
Probably a lot.
I teach stretching, so I want to be really mindful how I say this. There is a use for stretching, but it should not be the strategy. Stretching out tissue is great. It feels good. It has very measurable down regulatory effects. So if tissue's tight, intense, overactive, you stretching, it can help relax. But everybody's being told to stretch what's tight. We have to understand that what's tight is coming from the brain. If you were to knock somebody out with general anesthesia, you would find a super stiff person all of a sudden becomes hypermobile because their consciousness isn't putting the limiter on their movement. Stretching what's tight can be helpful, but moving what's tight will always be more infinitely helpful. The only time your brain will let go of tension is if it feels safe in that range of motion. So you cranking on stretches, it's why you feel tight doing stretches one day and that same stretch, same tensions the next day. Maybe it's 5% better and that's great. Maybe 30 days later, it's 10% better, but it just kind of never really goes away. It never fully leaves you. And my God, take a couple days off and you're right back to where you were day one with the tightness. Stretching doesn't change tissue tension. Movement does. So if we can bring a level of dynamic movement to your body, that is going to be the fastest way to resolve pain and mechanical issues. The only time stretching is prescribed usefully is when movement is so problematic it hurts like hell. So great, let's try positions where there is no movement and let's learn to breathe. Let's learn to relax into your body. But once we're past that phase, we got to get things moving, because if we don't, nothing's going to change. And I wish I learned that years earlier. I would have saved so many hours tugging on what was tight, hoping it was just going to like release. And that wasn't my experience, and it's not most.
What is one daily movement that you will never skip again for the rest of your life?
I'm going to share some hard-earned wisdom with you. And this is coming after having been given so many exercises, these hour-long routines. And when you have all this work that you have to do physically with your body, it feels like you're just piling more on top of an already full life. And when movement and taking care of your body starts to feel like a chore, we stop becoming consistent. And then in order to try and move again, it doesn't feel like just movement. It feels like we're now having to work through the shame of failing again or the pressure that we put on ourselves that we missed more days. So the advice I have for everybody and what I'm going to share with you is do one movement. Come up with your minimum standard, non-negotiable. It does not have to be the hardest exercise, nor does it have to be the most effective exercise, nor the most valuable. The most enjoyable exercise for you. Come your hardest days, your most hectic days, that is the one thing that you do and you feel good that you did it and showed up for yourself. Mine, very simple, kneeling hip flexor stretch. I run a lot, I sit a lot to teach people to move more. That's what I do. My hips historically are tight, so the most enjoyable thing is just getting a kneeling dynamic hip flexor stretch in. I feel like emotionally that's where I store a lot of tension. It's the one that is the easiest for me to say yes to, so I don't miss it. It's non-negotiable. It is what pulls me into my movement practice. And on the days where I do it, sometimes I'm already down on the ground and doing it. Let me do another one. And it always balloons into a more advanced movement practice that day, but it doesn't have to.
Yeah.
That's the point.
Such good advice. Can you show me what that looks like real quick?
I'll show you one thing. It's my favorite. Am I still in frame?
I'll do it with you.
Okay. All right. So here's my favorite movement. In a kneeling position, and if it doesn't feel comfortable on your knees, you put like a pillow, something soft, both hands on your leg, and you're just going to lean forward into it, right? We're not like trying to throw our upper body forward. Feel that back hip stretch and then come out of it. And we're going to do this for 1 minute on each side.
Feels really good.
Yeah, just rock back and forth. The further that front foot is out, the more the stretches we're going to get in the hip.
Do you want to get your knee like a
star? Perfect.
Okay.
That was great.
So get your, like, the front knee over the toe, even, like, as far as you can go.
We're practicing exactly what happens in a squat. We're practicing exactly what happens when we go down the stairs, that the knee moves over the toe. So this is my favorite because two things are happening. Number one, we're stretching the back hip. And number two, it's just like a mini little strength signal into the front leg.
Yeah.
So a minute of forward, backward motion on this side, and then we're just going to switch.
I like that it's a stretch, but that you're moving through it.
And that's all you're doing is you're just touching it and then coming out of it.
A little bounce.
And over time, we can get lower and it's just going to feel more and more open. And we get a little bit of strength. We get a little bit of flexibility and mobility and stability. So this is one of those exercises where we get a well-rounded stimulus and a well-rounded outcome. So this is my minimum standard of motion. It feels the best. It's the easiest to say yes to. I can do it when I'm typing out an email. I can do it when we're watching Love Island, whatever. Not that we watch Love Island in this house.
I don't even know what that is.
Oh, great. Amazing. You guys know? Nobody knows.
I know what it is.
I'll have to look it up.
Okay, so that's for my hips. I'm going to show you one for yours.
Okay.
So what I'd like you to do is stand up, and you can face me. All right, both feet pointing forwards. And you can bend your knees. I want just a really casual bend forward towards the ground.
Okay.
So bend forward and reach towards the ground. Okay. Kind of like a gorilla. Keep your knuckles on the ground.
Okay.
Good. Just like that. Bend your knees. Lower your hips a little bit more. Relax your head. And then now raise your hips up towards the ceiling here. So higher hips.
That?
Yep. Take a second and then come back down. Lift your hips up. Press your knees back and then come back down. We're not trying to rush in and out of each position. I want you to take some big, deep breaths, send the knees back, the neck relaxes. There you go.
Yeah, I feel this.
Yeah, see how we're trying to almost use the shoulders and the neck to do this? This is your 1 minute a day where you send work and tension into the back of the legs. You're gonna find it maybe burns a little bit. There's a little bit of strength. There's a little bit of stretch. Big, deep breaths. Send the hips up and the knees back, hold for a second, feel that benefit, and come out of it.
I'm like shaking as I'm doing that.
It's just 1 minute a day. And maybe for you, it's another little hack is put the remote on the ground. So maybe you and your husband like TV time, whatever it is. Maybe you like, spending those last couple minutes with your kids, put like the bottle on the ground, whatever you do. That's your signal. If I'm going to bend forward, I might as well just get my minute of exercise in.
Yeah.
If the remote is on the ground, well, if I got to get down on the ground or bend forward to pick it up, I might as well just do that minute of movement. And it's these little environmental hacks that help take care of you. You know, most people will get way bigger of a house. It's more house than they need. And they're running around like crazy taking care of their house. A home should take care of you. Your environment should take care of you. So if you can start to hack your environment a little bit by maybe putting the remote on the ground, a bottle of water on the ground, your laptop on the ground, your environment is going to start to influence your movement, as that's the signal before I go get it, let me just get it done and out of the way with. and now your environment is taking care of you instead of you trying to force and always like consciously have to say yes into things that you don't want to do. And you can make it really easy.
Man, thank you so much. This has been so helpful for me, and I've learned a ton from you, and I know everyone listening will as well. Where can people find you and learn more about you and your program?
Yeah, so you can learn more about my program, www.painacademy.net, and any of the social handles at Pain Academy. There's so much free information out there.
Yeah, there's a lot.
Check it out, give it a little bit of time, and watch what happens.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.